Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is life like for the brave and compassionate souls who commit themselves to helping people caught in the world's crisis zones? And what should prospective aid workers know before they sign on for these important but extremely challenging jobs? Humanitarian aid workers routinely head into regions where large numbers of people are threatened by conflict, political persecution, and natural disaster, doing whatever they can to relieve suffering and protect local populations from further trauma. As my guest today will tell us, the day-to-day realities of those very important jobs are often very different from what outsiders might imagine, but it's critical that the realities of that work are understood by those who aspire to undertake such efforts, as well as by those who might wish to help fund them. Alexander Betts is director of the Humanitarian Innovation Project at the University of Oxford. Louise Bloom has worked for Oxfam and Engineers Without Borders, and she's now with the Humanitarian Innovation Project. And Eric Abild is with the Norwegian Refugee Council. All three are in town to take part in a panel discussion tomorrow as part of Engineering and Humanity Week at SMU. Welcome, all of you, to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what sort of work falls under the definition of humanitarian aid?
Humanitarian aid can be seen in very broad terms. When we think about humanitarianism, the common general understanding is that it's about helping vulnerable people, not on the basis of who they necessarily are, but based on our common humanity, the idea that we want to have compassion for and support people in need in crisis situations just because they're also people and human beings. And that's really at the core of the activities involved. And so it relates to a range of situations, conflict and war zones, whether people are crossing an international border from such situations or staying in their own country and moving geographically. It can also involve people fleeing environmental disasters and natural disasters, or people simply fleeing dictatorships and human rights abusing regimes that need support.
I think a lot of people imagine this sort of aid happening with non-governmental organizations and a lot of expats sort of coming in to do all this work. And it's worth pointing out that there are, in the regions that are being served, also a lot of local people doing the work. Can you talk about the sort of breakdown between people who might come from elsewhere and come in to assist a local population and people who are part of that population?
Well, I work for Norway's largest humanitarian organization, and absolutely most of our staff, 95%+, are nationals from the countries where they actually come from. So we also, our staff come from the areas, and they work and they know the situation best, and they often have the best solutions. But often also local organizations are doing extremely important work, some places where other international organizations can't be, and also remittances sent by people in the region or maybe in the US that they're sending back. So this is not only something done by expatriates from the West.
And of course, there are people on the ground doing work, and there are people at headquarters raising money and organizing things. What's the breakout there?
So I think this will vary depending on the size of the organization and the locations. But often you're right, there are head office offices within charities and NGOs that do a lot of the kind of broader coordination. International fundraising might set procedures in place so that there's a kind of shown accountability and accountancy finance procedures that can track the project management. And then at the country level, that's where lots of the decisions are made and the hands-on kind of work happens. And obviously the budgets are managed at a day-to-day level with the national teams.
Is it pretty typical for people to move back and forth from, say, a head office out into the field and on and on?
Different organizations work in very different ways, but in many United Nations organizations, like the UN Refugee Agency, there's an idea of rotation, that people will be rotated around the world from one field location to another, and they might spend a short period of time in the headquarters location, whether it's, say, in Geneva or New York, and be involved in that policy coordination work before going back to the field. And I think it's fairly common for many humanitarian workers to regard the real rewards of the work to be in the field. And it's quite opposite to what you might expect, that many people don't like being in the big head office or the bureaucracy, but want to be out there really getting involved and supporting people at the field level.
One thing that really surprised me about my research, it was clear that organizations want the very best, most qualified people. I didn't realize how hard it is to get one's first job working as a humanitarian relief worker.
No, you're very right. And it's a bit of a chicken and egg challenge that you need experience often to get a job, and to get experience, you need a job. But I think there are very many people who want to become humanitarian workers. And in Norwegian Refugee Council, we often have 200, 300 applicants for a position. But it's not impossible. And if you have something to contribute, if you have a skill, or, and most importantly, if you have the attitude, it's possible. So it's not, some people think it's impossible, and it's not. If you have something to contribute and you're willing to look around, there are many ways to help.
Is there an ideal academic background that candidates ought to have?
We run an academic teaching program in Oxford, which is a master's in what's called Refugee Studies and Forced Migration. And it's really a one-year humanitarian teaching program. And every year people ask questions about what would make them ideally qualified for the work in the field. And there's no ideal qualification. The desire to make a contribution and the desire to help and the attitude and approach is one very important thing. But of course, what's really important to bear in mind is that people need some kind of skill, some kind of expertise. Humanitarianism breaks down into sectors, and if we're contributing across the board in areas like water and sanitation, shelter, food relief, any kind of skill, whether it's engineering, whether it's more on the policy and diplomatic end of the spectrum, can be useful. So any skills that apply in day-to-day life with the right attitude and the appropriate training for context can be very useful.
I very much agree. And I studied at the RSC and took the master's there, and I can account for it was a very useful education. But sometimes I think it's a problem that it's too much academics and that people overcomplicate. You need people who can understand connections and contexts, but to have concrete skills, can be a doctor or engineer, but also in completing processes. And I think from the private sectors, humanitarian organizations have a lot to learn in terms of efficiency, to get a project from A to B, to be able to make a difference. And you need practical human understanding to be able to work together and get a project from A to B.
Yeah, speaking from my perspective, I came from an engineering background, actually. So in terms of looking at the operationality that Eric just mentioned, getting practically things from A to B, lots of people do come in with finance skills, engineering skills, logistics skills, project management skills from a variety of backgrounds. And yeah, bringing those skills into the kind of hands-on day-to-day activities is obviously what is really, really valuable in country.
So in terms of that first position, I would imagine people think, well, I volunteered with my church and we went and built something. Or are there skill sets that people bring to the table that turn out not to be all that useful in terms of experiences that people bring to the table that turn out not to be all that helpful?
I think the really important thing is to have not just an academic background. A lot of people assume that because they've been to the right school, had the right education, they can walk into the field and have something immediate to offer. A huge amount of what qualifies people is, as Eric has suggested, gathering the right kind of experience. So being willing at the outset to maybe start with an internship that might not even be paid or might be on a low pay level is very important. And there are opportunities out there across Africa. Many NGOs need support, they need staff, but it's usually not necessarily the fashionable organizations. It might not be the big United Nations organization, but a local field office. And I think most people have something to offer and contribute with the right motivation. And I think that's a really important message to put forwards. So it's not that any skill is going to be redundant, but a willingness to apply the skills that you have to a particular context and realize that there are differences from maybe working in Dallas on the one hand to what it is to work, say, in a refugee camp in Kenya, and being able to learn and adapt to that context over time is a very important idea to have.
Yeah, I agree. And again, being a humanitarian is not a profession. And although you maybe are 40 years or you haven't worked, many people have things. Anyone can be a humanitarian from any nation or any background. It has to do with commitment and the way to approach things and a willingness to contribute. So definitely to break down the barriers. And from any sector, people can be a humanitarian.
Do most field workers start young? Or is this something that occasionally people in mid-career decide that they want to reapply their skills?
I guess certainly from my experience, I definitely started relatively young. And I was fortunate enough to get onto a training internship program with Save the Children UK, where I then was given the opportunities to get the experiences and learn in a more controlled way, I guess, and support, and very nurtured and supported in that. And I wouldn't say I was the majority, and I did have seen lots of people come across after many years, actually, of building these different skills, like I'd mentioned, from finance or even communications and this kind of thing, and transferring their skills that they do have into a kind of new context. So I think it's probably quite a mix.
Mm-hmm. So elaborate a little, if you would, Louise, about how you decided that this was the kind of work you wanted to pursue after studying engineering. And we'll ask Eric and Alex about this as well. But how did this line of work strike you as the right one?
Yeah, sure. So I studied engineering at the University of Cambridge in the UK. And from the very start, actually, of my engineering education, I was involved in a kind of extracurricular way with Engineers Without Borders UK. So I think there's Engineers Without Borders chapter in the US as well, and doing similar activities on kind of raising awareness, how can engineers use their skill, practical skills, in a new context that really isn't taught in the curriculum. So yeah, I was really inspired from that perspective, so using the skills that I was learning for more than just kind of commercial goals that you're taught a lot of, and building bridges and that kind of thing. So looking at more the social aspects and a kind of context that is a bit further away from home, but where you can have a real impact. So my involvement with that really was my motivation to look further and keep learning and try and figure a way to use my skills in my career for that international development sector.
How about you, Eric?
I think I always wanted to, as simple as may sound, to help people, and I try to stick to that as my core motivation. And it's an issue of scale, and I try to ask myself first. The first question is: do you want to make a difference? Do you want to try to push in the right direction in terms of injustice? But the second question is much, much harder: what can you do? How can you contribute? And I considered becoming a doctor, and I considered many things, but I ended up on studying refugee situations, and specifically refugee camps, and specialized more towards the politics of humanitarian work, both the politics behind why humanitarian needs arise. Like Syria today, it's a man-made political humanitarian crisis, mm-hmm. but also the political impacts of humanitarian work. So I thought that was one way. If you can make a difference in a refugee camp like Dadaab on the border with Somalia, where there's 500,000-600,000 refugees, if you can make a little difference there, give people some tools of empowering them to give them better opportunities, it can make a real impact. And it's a huge privilege, and it still feels like it as when I was a little boy.
How about you, Alex?
I think, like many people who enter this field, I had a moment in my life when my eyes were opened to challenges that people face that I wasn't previously aware of. And that was when I was 19 years old, and I spent a summer doing voluntary work in a refugee reception centre in the Netherlands. And what really struck me, and at the time surprised me, was not that people were in need or really struggling, but their ability to adapt, to thrive, and to make a success of their lives, and to have hope and even ambition under the most difficult of circumstances. And I spent many of my evenings in that context speaking to people from all over the world who had fled really awful conflicts, dreadful human rights abuses and atrocities from Bosnia, from Kosovo, from Congo, from Somalia, around the world. And I thought, not only did I want to help those people, but I could derive inspiration from being part of working with these, in many cases, really inspiring people.
We are talking about the realities of working as a humanitarian aid worker with Alexander Betts, Louise Bloom, and Eric Abild. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. It has been inspired by the SMU Engineering and Humanity Week, which takes place all week. And tomorrow, these three guests will be panelists. We will return to the conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd.
We're speaking this hour with Eric Abild of the Norwegian Refugee Council, Louise Bloom, who's worked for Oxfam and Engineers Without Borders and is now with the Humanitarian Innovation Project, and Alexander Betts, director of the Humanitarian Innovation Project, which is headquartered at the University of Oxford. All three will participate in a live panel discussion tomorrow as part of Engineering and Humanity Week at SMU. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. So I would imagine when you all sit next to someone on an airplane or you meet someone at a cocktail party and they hear what you do, there is what they think you do and what you actually do. And I wonder if you can talk about, for field work in particular, the biggest misconceptions that you've run into.
Well, I'll start. And I think the romanticism that it's all smiley stories and you help people and you feel great and things go well. The reality is that you work with very big problems and very serious problems. Humanitarian needs, it's about the basic life, shelter, food, water. People who are dying from these things. And you work in very difficult situations and contexts with problems and very limited resources. So it's hard. And it's all what you can do together. It's not you as an individual or as a small organization that can do a big impact. It's to work together with others, with the local population, with the state, with institutions to make a difference.
I would imagine that given that the populations you're working with are at probably the most stressful times that they will experience in their lives, while they may be happy to have help, they may not always be in a position to sort of say to you, you're the best person I've ever met, and thank you so much for your help, and welcome to our community. And I wonder about how you sort of cope with that when you feel like you're working very hard, but it may not be understood to be enough at the time.
Mm. And I think that is one of the challenges. So as you quite rightly pointed out, there are this romanticized image, if you like, of helping people and feeling like you do have an impact, which is certainly an element. And as Eric talked about his motivations, and certainly part of my motivations in terms of using my skills for more like a social good and helping people, that element exists, but it's not without these really hard challenges actually. And I guess having self-reflection and having time to think about it and making sure that you aren't overstretched and overworked and give yourself time to have a break. So, for example, I worked in the Haiti response for the earthquake in 2010, and we were working 19-hour days for mm-hmm. the first few even months. But making sure that, you do, take a step back. And obviously the great teams that you're working with and the national teams especially, that helps some of those challenges. Working together as a team and building new relationships in that way is very kind of gets you through some of the challenges. But I think it's a constant struggle for lots of, especially international aid workers coming into countries. The conflict between, you probably will have a nice bed to sleep in, whereas you drive outside your office or your guest house where you're staying and you see people sleeping under plastic sheeting on the streets. And mm-hmm. there are obviously, really harsh living conditions and situations that are preventing people from living their lives and even causing mortal.
And it's got to be hard when in a place like Haiti where you're working 19-hour days, there's never a good time where you're like, okay, well, things are done for today. I'll sort of, kick back and go write some emails. Do you just have to almost discipline yourself to do that so that you'll be fresh for the next day?
So I think that is, a really good question. And there's always more to do. Mm-hmm. And I think it's part of the nature of the work and the people that are motivated to do that. You are really passionate and you're there for much more than just your salary. And the adrenaline keeps you going for a certain extent, especially in an emergency period. So there is no stopping. You just have to get done as much as you can. So I guess in terms of the balance, it is just about knowing your own limitations so that you don't burn out, because if you get overstressed, then you're not really any use to anybody. Mm-hmm. So I guess just having that self-reflective understanding and knowing what your own limitations are.
Are there times when the people that you're serving think you actually have more power, more influence, more money, more resources than you actually do?
I think that's very inevitable. I encounter this an awful lot of the time, particularly as a researcher. So as an academic, I go into these situations, not necessarily as a humanitarian, but researching humanitarian responses and the politics of humanitarianism. And even when I interview people, whether they're displaced populations, refugees, or victims of humanitarian disasters, the expectation is that because I'm a white person coming from the West, because I'm attached to an institution they may have heard of, whether it's working with the University of Oxford or representing an organization like the United Nations Refugee Agency, that I can change their life in a dramatic way, that I might be able to enable them to be resettled from where they are to the United States or Europe. And of course, it's very challenging and often uncomfortable to manage those expectations and to have to say to desperate people that there's a limit to what you can offer and what you can provide, but that I want to interview them or I want to talk to them, and those expectations have to be very carefully managed in a very diplomatic way.
And also to be concrete, humanitarian needs don't only arise in Africa in conflict. You have natural disasters like here in the US with Hurricane Katrina and Sandy. And it's people who are losing their homes and their livelihoods. And you try to help, and in the US you try, but it's a desperate situation and you have limited resources and limited ways. So you're trying to make a positive difference in a very difficult and negative situation.
What does it take to connect with the people you're serving on a human level, but also remain detached enough to not get completely mired in their suffering and be sort of unable to function?
I think it's always really important to keep in mind that you're dealing with people. And that sounds like a very boring, dull, banal thing to say. But I think when we look through a humanitarian lens, we often see categories: the refugee, the victim, the internally displaced person. But these are human beings in every sense of the word. And that means that while we're in many cases trying to maintain the basic minimal conditions of survival, particularly in an emergency phase, human life is about so much more than that. It's about art, it's about sport, it's about culture. And standing back and creating little spaces in which you can connect with people in those universal ways, where you recognize the things that I, as a British person, have in common with a Somali person that are the same across humanity, can really break down those barriers. So in a lot of my early work, I connected with people by playing football with refugee men, soccer. Mm-hmm. And soccer was a very powerful way to get to meet people and connect, and a great leveler to link people. Music has a similarly powerful effect. Elements of the arts do. So I think those are ways in which, in the small spaces that are allowed, you can really link to people and create a basis of common conversations, even across different cultures and different circumstances.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking about what it's really like to be a humanitarian aid worker. Let's go on the phone now to Margaret in Dallas. Hello, Margaret.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
I was wondering, to what degree do you engage the refugees themselves in helping solve the day-to-day problems in refugee camps?
I think this is a wonderful question. Thank you very much for asking it. The project that we're involved in at the University of Oxford is called the Humanitarian Innovation Project. And at its core, what it's trying to do is change the paradigm through which we approach humanitarian questions. So rather than imposing solutions from the outside, taking a very heavy top-down approach, it's trying to engage in a very participatory way with listening to refugees themselves, empowering them to find their own solutions on a day-to-day basis. So in Uganda and East Africa, we're trying to develop a project where, rather than just giving refugees shelter, basic food, health, we want to support their entrepreneurship, their creativity, and their talent by, for instance, providing microcredit, mentorship, training, and really helping people to help themselves. This is an area that's been far too neglected in refugee response, but is gradually being put on the agenda more and more.
What does it take to, I mean, I would imagine at for certain assignments, you have the luxury of spending some time preparing, learning about the culture, getting yourself ready, and sometimes there are emergencies that don't allow for that. When you have to sort of hit the ground running and you don't yet know much about a particular culture, how do you engage with people who might see the world in different ways, certainly share a common humanity, but have a very different way of understanding the world?
Mm-hmm. So I mentioned already the Haiti earthquake, mm-hmm. And I was on call as soon as the earthquake was announced and left home within 24 hours. Mm. So I arrived in Dominican Republic, actually, where lots of our aid was being transported over to Haiti because the airports and the markets were closed in Haiti in the first few weeks. So this was, yeah, an exact example where I didn't really know what context I was going to arriving. I didn't really have any time to look up cultural aspects. So you're often given like a kind of brief background and analysis of the situation, but it rarely actually includes any cultural elements. It will be how many people have been affected by the earthquake, what's the situation, what's the state of the kind of local shelter and services. So I think the most important thing, certainly from my perspective, and a little bit as Alex touched on, is I guess just being really open and getting to know people as people, and yeah, being not bring trying to avoid bringing lots of your assumptions and cultural assumptions, especially when you're working in a new environment. And I guess this chimes quite nicely with the things we spoke about at the beginning, that getting experience is important. If you've never experienced living in another culture, then it could potentially be quite dangerous to be put into an emergency situation and have yourself quite a difficult time to cultural shock or whatever, but also the potential of like offending people or not really having that just awareness and taking a step back to have time and absorb and learn as you go and as you're kind of trying to get going as quickly as possible, learning the culture as you go along on the job.
So you have obligations, obviously, to the population you're serving, but also to the other members of your team. And I would imagine some people arrive, even for their first assignment, sort of prepared. And there are other people who, no matter how much they've studied and no matter how much they've been vetted, discover very quickly that this work is not for them, which sort of puts everybody else in a tough spot. Have you experienced anything like that with a teammate?
I think most people who have worked in the field have experienced that, and it's a challenge because many places it's very dangerous to work. There are real threats of kidnappings, bombings, shootings, areas of war, and it's a challenge. But it's to try to find the common ground and to work together as a team. And here in Dallas this week, we have been having a student competition where interdisciplinary young graduate students are to find a solution to a water problem in a refugee camp. And to see the different backgrounds they had, but how they worked together to find a solution, it's a small, small picture, but it's the same in the field, that you have to find common solutions and common ways. And if there's one person in the team that does not have the same approach to security, you have to deal with it. You can't just look away and say it's going to go away. And you have to find solutions together. And again, it's the local population that will keep you safe and will advise you. Refugees themselves is our most important source of protection and security.
One of the things that's constantly struck me around the world is that the quality of teams in the same organization varies from place to place.
Sure.
You can get big teams, you can get small teams, but the quality of the leadership really matters. And it's amazed me how much in humanitarianism individuals matter. Humanitarian response is often seen as very bureaucratic, very organization-driven, but ultimately what makes the difference is the individuals, having charismatic, inspiring figures who are motivated for the right reasons can make such a difference to transforming a team from being ineffective to being extremely effective and capable of making a big difference.
You were saying, Eric, sort of off when we were in a break, that you feel so very serious having this conversation. And I'm wondering if one of the charismatic qualities that ends up mattering a lot is a sense of humor in the field.
Actually, in NRC, Norwegian Refugee Council, we have it as on all our sort of criteria for qualification in applications. At the bottom, it says that a sense of humor helps. Mm-hmm. And I really think that for any staff member in any organization, if it's humanitarian or private in Norway or in Africa, to be able to get things done is very important. And the second thing, to be able to work together. And I think humor is one important aspect there. And to be able to also overcome very hard situation, humor can be very good.
Is there gallows humor in these places? Would you admit to that if it existed? I see everyone smiling and looking. I mean, it's a way of dealing with stress, right? To sort of joke away from people who would be hurt by it about the dire situation.
So, as Eric and Alex have obviously quite rightly pointed out, you're in such a hard environment that obviously the humour is really important to keep, I guess, sane to a certain extent. Certainly from my personal experience, the type of humour I guess we're talking about is, I mean, you're faced with different challenges almost every hour in an emergency response. Like the truck hasn't turned up, the supplier hasn't delivered, the
like just
community
when you think
have
it
moved.
Can't get any worse.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so that in itself is, you know, you have to be jest around that or kind of take it lightly, I guess, taking everything lighter than it could be taken in a different context.
Right,
so you're
right.
Faced with hundreds of problems every second and kind of having a really proactive, I think proactivity is one of the most important things, but having a really proactive attitude and positive attitude. So I think the kind of humour, it's almost, yeah, it's not, I've never experienced people kind of laughing at explicit things, but it's that kind of lighthearted, positive attitude. It's that problem-solving attitude, mm-hmm. and that definitely gets you through. And working in a team in a positive way is, I guess, how I'd kind of reflect on that and from my personal experience. And that is one of the most valuable things, because if you dwell on the problem, then you're going to stress out even quicker than you would do otherwise and not be of any use.
You explained that so much more gracefully than my question sort of led you to, and I appreciate that. That was sort of what I was interested in, like the sense that it's frustrating and hard, but you can't let each setback push you that much farther.
Yeah, and you really, I guess you wouldn't last very long if you did, and I guess it's making sure that you understand your personal kind of limitations and the importance, again, of having a little bit of experience, at least overseas and in difficult environments, before you're thrown into a very difficult situation and have to hit the ground running in an emergency.
We're speaking this hour with Louise Bloom and Alexander Betts and Eric Abild. All three are in town to take place in a panel discussion tomorrow as part of Engineering and Humanity Week at Southern Methodist University about the realities of working as a humanitarian aid worker. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about the realities of serving as a humanitarian relief worker with three people who will all participate in a live panel discussion tomorrow as part of Engineering and Humanity Week at Southern Methodist University. Louise Bloom has worked for Oxfam and Engineers Without Borders. She's now with the Humanitarian Innovation Project. Alexander Betts is the director of that project, which is headquartered at the University of Oxford. And Eric Abild is with the Norwegian Refugee Council. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. We've got lots of folks on the line who want to talk to all of you. I do want to ask about this, about living conditions, about privacy. It's not like any other job where at the end of the day you sort of turn things off. You're still far from home in many cases. Talk about the flexibility required to cope with living in these circumstances?
I think conditions vary dramatically depending on the type of humanitarian response. So there's a distinction that's important to make in humanitarian work between the emergency phase, mm-hmm. where a crisis, a war, an atrocity has just broken out, versus, on the other hand, a more settled, established situation like a refugee camp that's existed for a long time or a community that's being supported in an urban area. Within the emergency phase, or within particularly dangerous areas, a lot of humanitarian workers have to live in what's called compounds. And those can be living conditions where your privacy is really strongly compromised. You're living in a small, secure area, often having to share accommodation with other humanitarian workers. And it may be that you're rotated out on rest and rehabilitation every 8 to 10 weeks, or sometimes slightly longer, to get out and get some respite. But your privacy will be really compromised. But in many other situations where it's more settled, people will be able to maintain relatively normal day-to-day living standards. They might have their own apartment, their own home, drive to work in a car. And, of course, there's the stress of the job. There's the day-to-day reality of the challenges they're encountering. But there can be much more privacy, and people can often live not in the deepest field, but in capital cities or towns around the world.
In some ways, it's also privileged because you don't have other commitments and family commitments and social commitments that you maybe have back home. And in some ways, it's a glorified life, and you have holidays that you can go home and only be home. And I have nothing but respect for those people who work in homeless shelters or rape centers or crisis, that you go and give it all, and then you have to go home to your family and take care of your kids and other things. So you can be a humanitarian in the US or in your own country. And as I said, most of our staff are national staff. And it's very, very, very awe-inspiring that they live in capitals like Baghdad or Mogadishu or in the eastern of Congo, and they help, and they do exactly what I do as an expatriate with good salary. And then they go home and then take care of their families in very difficult situations.
Is this work for expats conducive to having a long-term romantic partner or children? Or do you have to sort of put that sort of thing off?
I guess from my personal experience, I spent a few years working overseas and my partner was back in the UK. So I can certainly reflect on that from a personal perspective. So as we talked about, the living conditions, of course, vary completely between different contexts. And I guess there's almost two extremes I can pull on from my experience. I lived in Burma for a while, and it was about 9 months after the cyclone that they experienced in 2008. So we had times where we'd spend time in the delta sleeping on bamboo mats on the wooden floor, which obviously they're kind of harder living conditions that you might be used to. And you can get very lonely, although there might be people around if you're in a new place and you have just arrived and you haven't had a chance to make lots of friends. It can be a relatively isolating experience. And again, you are away from your family and friends and partners. And then the kind of opposite extreme, but then still, I guess, is isolating in a similar way, is in an emergency response. For example, in Haiti, we did live in a compound. I mean, actually, in the first few weeks, all the staff, expatriate staff, were sleeping in tents in the garden. So that was a very almost claustrophobic social situation. You don't really have any break. You're working and living with the same people, and you don't have any freedom of movement to walk in the street because of the security situation. And even when you're surrounded by those people, you can still feel, I guess, internally relatively isolated because you are so far from your family and friends. And we spoke about the positive aspects of, working collectively as a team, and you really do make the best friends that you'll keep forever in those situations. But I guess it's a balance, and not really a balance, almost a conflict
juggling
within
act.
Yourself.
The unfortunate reality, though, is that some United Nations humanitarian organizations have extremely high divorce rates, mm-hmm. that the nature of the work does put pressure on family life. And I think there's more that organizations can do and should do to make the work more compatible with sustaining a family and a private life. And that means that anyone who's thinking of embarking on this work needs to probably think very carefully about the extent to which their family and friends support and understand the kind of work they want to do. And some humanitarian organizations in some situations allow families to travel with the worker, whereas there are some duty stations and places that are unsuitable for young children or to bring partners.
Like diplomacy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it really requires consideration about what kind of humanitarian work is right for the individual and their own family setup.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Alex in Dallas. Hi, Alex.
Hi. I'd like to read more about refugee issues, but I don't have a lot of time and I don't really know where to begin. Can you suggest some good videos or books that would be good for a person who doesn't know a lot about the subject?
I think you could start by looking at a couple of websites, Alex. I might be a little biased in suggesting this, but the Refugee Studies Centre at Oxford University has a website. And on there we have a number of multimedia videos, some suggested readings, some working papers. So that might be a good start. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees website also has a number of multimedia videos and some readings. So I think those two sources might be a great start for you.
1-800-933-5372. We have yet another Alex on the line, also from Dallas. Hi, Alex.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am from originally from Africa, and I have experienced how employees of the UN and other organizations live life. And from my experience, they're extremely, their living condition is excellent. And in fact, they're overly highly paid. And in fact, I would like to ask you, Gaston, how do they respond to critics who say that, the majority of the budget of these big organizations are on their overhead and they are very little to disperse to the people in need. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I think it's a very important question, and I definitely think that most people working in the sector are aware of it, and it is an issue. But aid workers living in Darfur, for example, do not live in fantastic housing. They live in a container, and it depends from context to context, as Alex touched upon. But in terms of most of the funding going to overhead, that is wrong, but it varies very much from organization to organization. And some get funding from government, some get private funding, some have direct funding. But I think most organizations, at least big and serious organizations, try to have less than 10% on overhead management. And you strive and aim for, we are very aware of these issues, that 90 or plus more percent should go directly to the people in need.
Is it safe to assume that people do not go into humanitarian work for the money?
I think generally that's correct, but it's not universally true that people aren't motivated by the money. So in most humanitarian non-governmental organizations or non-profits, salaries are relatively low. The day-to-day quality of life in terms of the material rewards is relatively low. So for most people, no, of course, they're never going to go into this area for the money. But it's true that in, say, some of the United Nations humanitarian agencies, salaries can get quite high. And the international salaries are the same irrespective of which part of the world you're from. So if you come from a country where the average salary rate is low, the salary you would go up to, which could be $250,000 in a senior position, is an extremely high, strong inducement for a minority to go into this area. And I think this is a tension that can and does emerge in the humanitarian world, where some people are seen as being more highly paid than others, more materially rewarded than others, and that can create great tensions. So, for example, many organizations have a distinction between international staff and national staff, and the minority, as we touched upon earlier, of international staff often get paid far more than the national staff, and the national staff often are those that work the hardest in the most dangerous and difficult conditions. So I think generally it's safe to say people don't go into this area for the money, but that's not to say that there aren't people who do enter this, unfortunately, for the wrong motivation.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Steve in Dallas. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And thanks to the panelists for being there. This is a wonderful show. I really enjoy it. I have a full-time job and a family, but I'm really interested in doing what I can for, in particular, the refugees, but really any kind of humanitarian issues. How would someone like me get involved or do what I can do?
You can be a humanitarian anywhere. You don't have to travel to Africa or the other side of the world. You can make a massive contribution from Dallas. In relation to refugees, there are resettled refugee communities in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Many thousands of people, many community organizations. And there'll be nonprofits that provide services and support to those resettled refugees. Many of those organizations will be looking for volunteers to provide probably even just a few hours a week. I think the other thing that you can do, which can make a big contribution, is just to learn and understand and speak to people, to inform people about refugees. Because here in the United States or in Europe, where I come from, there are often really big misunderstandings about who refugees are. Often we think they're here because they choose to be here, or they're illegal migrants. But it's important just to convey to as many people as possible that refugees don't choose to be refugees. They leave the most desperate situations of violence, natural disaster, and atrocity. And getting that message out and understanding it is a contribution in itself.
When your work takes you from country to country or community to community, is it hard to leave people that you have bonded with, people that you have come to really identify with and care about?
Yeah, definitely. And again, I guess it's one of those conflicts between building amazing relationships in these places that you go with the community and your team, with your existing relationships and obviously great friends and bonds you have back home. And yeah, especially if you're only in a country for a relatively short period of time, even a year is quite a short period of time when you're talking about relationships and building friendships and trust between communities and friends. That, yeah, it's often really sad to leave. And I think that's probably one of the other challenges. I mean, we talked about the kind of conflict between living in nice conditions when people are sleeping under plastic sheeting in the street. And I think that's probably one of the other conflicts. And I've had often staff say to me, oh, you're leaving so soon. Well, people always come and go. And they're really disheartened. And it's not very nice and empowering for the local teams even, mm-hmm. let alone the local community. And it can be quite confusing in some situations. And I guess people decide how to deal with that in different personal ways. And certainly, I guess from my perspective, I've tried to keep in touch with the really close friends and colleagues that I have had in different countries and still, yeah, maintain your friendship, I guess, mm-hmm. is the main.
Yeah. Would you add anything to that?
No, I completely agree. And I'm sitting thinking of my friends and places I've been, and it's maybe not the hardest thing, but it's a very hard thing. And they live in very hard conditions, and some of them you don't know if they are able to survive, and their family members and their stories. So I think that I remember it as a privilege, getting to know them and learn from them and work with them. It's a very big privilege to travel into so many places and get to know people there in a quite intimate and close way.
My guests this hour have been Eric Abild with the Norwegian Refugee Council, Louise Bloom, who worked for Oxfam and Engineers Without Borders and is now with the Humanitarian Innovation Project at the University of Oxford. Alexander Betts was here as well. He is director of the Humanitarian Innovation Project. All three are in town to take part in a panel discussion tomorrow as part of Engineering and Humanity Week at SMU. It's been such a pleasure to have you all here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can download the podcast and learn more about the show at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.